Wars are extremely useful for governments to practice the tyranny of force. In order to make tyranny more palatable, half-truths must be instituted for the masses. In order to get the propaganda rolling, Wilson set up a committee called a Committee of Public Information. The Secretary of State Lansing, Secretary of War Baker, and Secretary of the Navy Daniels were a part of this committee. The chairman of the committee was George Creel, a Missouri journalist well known for his muckraking style. He had written a book, Wilson and the Issues, in 1916. Creel held one, and only one, meeting with the other men of the Committee on Public Information. The public was not enthused about the war, and it was Creel's job to infuse them with the patriotic fervor of sacrifice. One of his most successful schemes was the use of the Four-Minute Men. This was a group of men who gave a four-minute talk at movie theaters. This practice soon expanded to giving talks to churches, clubs, chamber of commerce, and union meetings. The first topic the speakers gave was universal service by a selective draft. The word conscription had been replaced with service. The post office solicitor, William H. Lamar, banned an Irish-American magazine from the mails for printing Thomas Jefferson's opinion that Ireland should be made a republic. Now, the U.S. only had a few men in the Bureau of Investigation at this time, not enough to investigate the problem of spies and anti-war protesters. So a man by the name of A. Bruce Bilaski came up with the idea, which would be known as the American Protective League, or APL for short. Soon, there were 250,000 members. These citizens looked for spies by opening suspects' mail, burglarizing their homes and offices, tapping their telephones, and planting listening devices in their parlors and bedrooms. They also turned out in massive force to make sure that draft registration day had no disruptions. Wilson was informed by Secretary of the Treasury William Gibbs McAdoo that they were getting out of hand. Wilson ignored his warnings. He did not criticize the Council of Defense or the American Defense Society, which changed their tactics from preaching to looking for spies and suppressing dissent. In New York, the Home Guard's leader declared that 10-year-olds were being organized in an anti-Yellow Dog League to detect disloyalty among their neighbors. In Missouri, local vigilante groups began sending out white, blue, and red cards to those suspected of dissent. One white card meant the person was under surveillance. The blue card meant he or she was in danger of arrest. The red card meant the Secret Service would soon be visiting. The State Council of Defense reported that so far it had not been necessary to send a red card. The white and blue induced silence. In New York, police raided meetings of Friends of Irish Freedom because they were speaking against conscription. A Boston labor union staged a protest parade down Tremont Street near the Common. One of their banners read, "If this is a popular war, why conscription? We demand peace." They were attacked by a well-organized group of soldiers and sailors who clubbed, kicked, battered, and pursued the marchers. The police watched with amusement and later arrested five of the marchers on charges of assault and battery. In Philadelphia, a socialist was jailed for 6 months for having an anti-war pamphlet which read, "Long live the Constitution of the United States." In West Virginia, another socialist wrote a pamphlet in which he predicted a militarized America. He got 6 months in jail. The Socialist Party's candidate for governor in Minnesota got 5 years in jail for accusing the Morgans and Carnegie for starting the war. Eugene Debs, the 63-year-old founder of the Socialist Party, got 10 years for pleading guilty to 10 violations of the Espionage Act. The fight soon went from the written word to the spoken word. John White, An Ohio farmer got 21 months in the penitentiary for declaring that the murder of women and children by German soldiers was no worse than the crimes that American soldiers committed in the Philippines during the 1900 to 1902 insurrection. An elderly South Dakota farmer got 5 years for urging a young man not to enlist in a war that was all foolishness. In Butte, Montana, vigilantes seized an IWW spokesman, Frank Little, dragged him behind a car, and hanged him to a light post. In Philadelphia, a federal attorney stated in a letter to the Attorney General, quote, "Our purpose, as I understand it, is to put the IWW out of business." Lenin and Trotsky were negotiating with Germany, yet Wilson was praising them for doing just the opposite. Hollywood got into the propaganda wars with movies depicting the typical German as a thick-necked, saber-scarred brute who killed old people and children for fun. Sometimes the audiences were worked up into such a rage against the Germans that the police were called in order to calm the populace. German Americans were favorite targets for the war rage. They were beaten up on the streets of Terre Haute, Indiana, and other cities. They were forced to kiss the flag or face many other punishments much worse. Yet, of the APL's 250,000 Secret Service sleuths, plus the real Secret Service, or the agents of the Bureau of Investigation, they caught only one German spy. At first, our soldiers were called Sammies, but General Pershing got the name changed to Doughboys, possibly because during the occupation of the Philippines, the dust covering the soldiers' uniforms looked like flour. The French were called Poilus. That meant hairy ones. In order to keep the army clean, a clause was inserted in the Selective Service Act that made it a crime to sell or give a drink to a serviceman. Brothels in the vicinity of army camps were closed, and some 15,000 women were convicted of prostitution and shipped to detention centers where most of them were held until 1920. Even amateurs or any woman who behaved promiscuously with soldiers were subjected to a physical examination to see if she had venereal disease. It must have worked somewhat. The rate of venereal disease was higher among officers than it was among enlisted men. Women volunteers were formed into local protective leagues to enforce the Selective Service Clause. During the 1870s, President Ulysses S. Grant promised the Mennonite leaders that they would never have to serve in an American army. The Mennonites are a German-American pacifist religious sect. They virtually refuse to a man to submit to conscription. They said they would be willing to serve in non-combatant roles as long as they did not have to wear a uniform. The leaders of this group went to Washington, D.C. and asked Secretary of War Baker if he would approve their stance. Baker said that if they would submit to conscription, he would respect their religious beliefs. He then sent a confidential order to camp commanders to persuade conscientious objectors to change their minds. They were to wear uniforms while they were being persuaded. About two-thirds of the objectors changed their minds and gave up their religion and became combatants. At one camp, the Conchies, as they were called, were sent into a field where they were persuaded by men on motorcycles until they collapsed. At another camp, a Mennonite resistor was scrubbed with brushes and then dipped in lye. At another, they were billeted with men infected with venereal disease. If they still resisted, they were court-martialed and some 110 were sentenced to terms ranging from 10 to 30 years at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. This is an honorable flag. Men have died for it. That's a quote from General Leonard Wood speaking to a group of Southerners. At Camp Fuston, General Wood discovered 1,000 men slept cold, with only one blanket to a man. The wells on which the camp depended for drinking water were infected with E. coli bacteria. When it rained heavily, Camp Fuston became a sea of mud. He called it a death trap for pneumonia. In France, 1/3 of the bullets were duds. Gas masks were little more than sieves. Trucks arrived without motors, wagons with no wheels. In boxes marked men's underwear, there were infants' nightshirts. They got a lot of useless items like bookcases, bathtubs, cuspidors, office desks, floor wax, stepladders, lawnmowers, safes, refrigerators, settees, sickles, stools, and window shades. More than $3 million worth of ships were built. Some of them were all right, but $635 million worth of them were made of wood and wouldn't float. The seams opened up and they sank. We paid for them, though, and somebody pocketed the profits. Even more was spent on the aircraft industry, but not one single plane was in the air. Airplanes and engine manufacturers felt that they, too, should get their just profits out of the war. And why not? Everybody else was getting theirs, so 1 million, count them if you live long enough, was spent by Uncle Sam in building airplanes and airplane engines that never left the ground. George Creel claimed that 22,000 planes would soon be darkening the skies. But after spending $840 million, the administration had not produced a single airplane. Not one plane or motor out of the $1 billion worth ordered ever got into a battle in France. There were only 1,000 American pilots in Europe and not a single U.S.-made plane for them to fly. Wilson then asked for another $7 billion from the public, who hated taxes. Theodore Roosevelt's son was killed flying an out-of-date French plane. The planes would have cost about $1,000 each, so our pilots were not issued parachutes because it was feared if the plane was disabled in the air, the pilot might bail out and not try to save that wonderful piece of equipment. The citizens at home were not too happy either. Wheat farmers were screaming about price controls, and labor was surly. Coal supplies were short, and some city officials were seizing coal trains and distributing the contents to the people. This left other parts of the country fuelless as winter began. People were freezing to death in prisons, orphanages, and mental hospitals. Soldiers were freezing to death in summer uniforms, lack of adequate shelter, and no blankets, both in France and the United States. One general described having several thousand sick men in a hospital built to hold 800 in the United States. The following are figures taken from the anti-war classic, War is a Racket. This book was written by America's most decorated soldier, a retired United States Marine general by the name of Smedley Butler. He had been awarded 2 Congressional Medals of Honor and would probably want another, but at the time, only enlisted men could be given the medal. The small booklet can be obtained from Amazon.com, and its text pertains mostly to the First World War. At the end of the war, there were at least 21,000 new millionaires and billionaires made in the United States. That's how many admitted their gains on income tax returns. How many others falsified their returns, no one knows. But how many of them shouldered a rifle? How many of them dug a trench? How many of them spent sleepless, frightened nights ducking shells, shrapnel, and machine gun bullets? How many of them parried the bayonet thrust of an enemy? How many of them were wounded or killed in battle? Out of war, nations acquire additional territory if they are victorious. Then they just take it. This newly acquired territory promptly is exploited by the few, the same self-few who wrung dollars out of blood in the war, while the general public shoulders the bill. And what is the bill? The bill renders a horrible accounting. Newly placed gravestones, mangled bodies, shattered minds, broken hearts and homes, economic instability, depression, and all its attendant miseries. Back-breaking taxation for generations and generations. Bankers are not the only ones making a profit out of the war. There are munitions makers, manufacturers, meat packers, and they all fare well. The powder people, the DuPonts, testified before a Senate committee that their powder saved the world for democracy, or something like that. How did they do during the war? From 1910 to 1914, their average earnings were $6 million a year. From 1914 to 1918, their average profits were $58 million a year, nearly 10 times their normal profits. Bethlehem Steel shunted aside making rails, girders, and bridges to manufacture war materials. Their 1910 to 1914 yearly earnings averaged $6 million. Their 1914 to 1918 average was $49 million a year. Okay, let's take a look at United States Steel. The normal earnings during the 4 or 5 year period prior to the war was $105 million a year. Not bad. Then along came the war. The average yearly profit for the period 1914 to 1918 was $240 million a year. Not bad either. Anaconda Copper averaged earnings during the pre-war years, 1910 to 1914, $10 million. During the war years, 1914 to 1918, profits leaped to $34 million per year. Or Utah Copper. It averaged $5 million per year during 1910 to 1914, and it jumped to an average of $21 million per year profits for the war period. Let's group these five with three smaller companies. The total yearly average profits of the pre-war period, 1910 to 1914, were $137,480,000. Then along came the war. The yearly average profits for this group skyrocketed to $480,300,000 per year, a little increase in profits of approximately 200%. For the three-year period before the war, the total profits of Central Leather Company were $3,500,000. That was approximately $1,167,000 a year. Well, in 1916, Central Leather returned a profit of $15,500,000. The General Chemical Company averaged a profit for the 3 years before the war of a little over $800,000 a year. Came the war, the profits jumped to $12 million per year, a leap of 1,400%. International Nickel Company, and you can't have a war without nickel, they showed an increase in profits from a mere average of $4 million a year to $73,500,000 a year. That's an increase of 1,700%. American Sugar Refining Company averaged $2 million a year for the 3 years before the war, and in 1916, they had a profit of $6 million. Listen to Senate document number 259. The 65th Congress, reporting on corporate earnings and government revenues, said that considering the profits of 122 meat packers, 153 cotton manufacturers, 299 garment makers, 49 steel plants, and 340 coal producers during the war, profits under 25% were exceptional. For instance, the coal companies made between 100% and 7,856% on their capital stock during the war. The Chicago Packers doubled and tripled their earnings. Take the shoe people. They like war. It brings business with abnormal profits. They made huge profits on sales abroad to our allies. You know, like the munitions manufacturers and armament makers, they also sold to the enemy. A dollar's a dollar, whether it comes from Germany or from France. But they did well by Uncle Sam, too. For instance, they sold Uncle Sam 35 million pairs of hobnailed service shoes. There were 4 million soldiers, so each soldier had 8 pairs of shoes. They were good shoes, but when the war was over, Uncle Sam had a matter of 25 million pairs left over. But they were all bought and paid for, profits recorded, and the profits were pocketed. There was still lots of leather left, so the leather people sold your Uncle Sam hundreds of thousands of McClellan saddles for the cavalry. But there wasn't any American cavalry overseas. Somebody had to make a profit on it, so we had a lot of McClellan saddles. Also, somebody had a lot of mosquito netting. They sold your Uncle Sam 20 million mosquito nets for the use of the soldiers overseas. I suppose the boys were expected to put over them as they tried to sleep in the muddy trenches, one hand scratching cooties on their back and the other making passes at scurrying rats. Well, not one of these mosquito nets ever got to France. Anyhow, these thoughtful manufacturers wanted to make sure no soldier would be without his mosquito net, so 40 million additional yards of mosquito netting were sold to Uncle Sam. There were pretty good profits in mosquito netting in those war days, even if there were no mosquitoes in France. I suppose if the war had lasted just a little longer, the enterprising mosquito netting manufacturers would have sold your Uncle Sam a couple of consignments of mosquitoes to plant in France so that more mosquito netting would be in order. And the stocking manufacturers, and the uniform manufacturers, and the cap manufacturers, and the steel helmet manufacturers, they all got their profits. When the war was over, some 4 million sets of equipment knapsacks and the things that go to fill them crammed warehouses on this side. Now they are being scrapped because the regulations have changed and the contents. But the manufacturers collected their wartime profits, and on them they still do it over and over again and wait for the next time. One very versatile patriot sold Uncle Sam 12 dozen 48-inch wrenches. Oh, they were nice wrenches. The only trouble was that there was only one nut ever made that was large enough for these wrenches. That is the one that holds the turbines at Niagara Falls. Well, after Uncle Sam had bought them and the manufacturer had pocketed the profits, the wrenches were put on freight cars and shunted all around the United States in an effort to find use for them. When the armistice was signed, it was indeed a sad blow to the wrench manufacturer. He was just about to make some nut to fit the wrenches. Then he planned to sell these nuts, too, to your Uncle Sam. Still another had the brilliant idea that colonels shouldn't ride in automobiles, nor should they even ride horseback. One had probably seen a picture of Andy Jackson riding on a buckboard. Well, some 6,000 buckboards were sold to Uncle Sam for the use of colonels. Not one of them was used, but the buckboard manufacturer got his war profit. It has been estimated by statisticians and economists and researchers that the war cost your Uncle Sam $52 billion. Of this sum, $39 billion was expended on the actual war period. This expenditure yielded $16 billion in profits. That is how 21,000 billionaires and millionaires got that way. This $16 billion profit is not to be sneezed at. It is quite a tidy sum. And it went to very few. And let us not forget the bankers who financed this great war. If anyone had the cream of the profits, it was the bankers. Being partnerships rather than incorporated organizations, they do not have to report to stockholders, and their profits were as secret as they were immense. How the bankers made their millions and their billions, I do not know, because those little secrets never become public, even before a Senate investigating committee. The war ended on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918. In 200 days, 50,300 doughboys were killed. Another 198,059 were wounded in action. 62,668 died of disease. 38,815 of the 62,668 died in training camps in the United States. 4,503 were killed in accidents. Almost 1,000 committed suicide. When minor causes were added to the total deaths, there were 120,139. In 1930, the Veterans Bureau estimated that war-related diseases, wounds, and other kinds of trauma had raised the total to 460,000 deaths. Men disabled by gas attacks were particularly prone to die young. More than 41,000 men were shell shock victims, many of them hospitalized for the rest of their lives. Well, that does it for today and for the bloody First World War. Please join me next week, and we'll give you some information on the bankers' behavior after the war.